All right, we're live. Welcome to the Tattoo Weekly. And we've got Marvin Moskowitz with us today. Of course, Vaughn Baker, the co-host of the show. I'm not Gabe Ripley. I'm James Wisdom, and I'm going to be filling in for some of these duties today. Thank you for joining us. Again, this is going to be a really awesome interview with Tattoo Legend. Let me just do some intro stuff. Welcome to Guy Etch's Reinventing the Tattoo Network, where tattooers, collectors, apprentices, and the curious are all encouraged to join these live stream and real world events. We're beaming out nearly every single day. And so with your help and the help of the streamers, we're putting together a quality network. You can also find Reinventing the Tattoo at these fine places, the Apple App Store, the Google Play Store, or on YouTube, Facebook. There's even a Roku channel. We're also available on all the major podcast directories such as Apple and Spotify. So be sure to find out more by visiting Reinventing the
Tattoo. You're breaking up a little.
Oh no. Be sure to find out more by visiting reinventingthetattoo.com. Hopefully that'll do it for our introductions. Let's jump right into the interview. With us today, we have Marvin Moskowitz, again, Tattoo Legend. I have some interesting questions to ask you, Marvin, but
okay.
I guess I'll just sort of start with, you know, try to prompt some stuff here. How about some of your earliest influences?
Early influences?
Yeah, but your early
influences. To tell you the truth,
yeah,
the only influences I actually had was my father and my uncle, Bowery Stan, and my father. I'm from the era where if a tattoo artist visited your shop, it wasn't to say hello, it was to see if you're busy and see what you're doing. So there weren't too many influences. I knew Tony Polito very well. My father's only 17 years older than me, so a lot of his friends became my friends as I got older. I knew Coney Island Freddy. I met Tony Cambria, the pirate, just here and there. We would go out to Jersey sometimes, and they would stop and see him. And the pirate thought that they were there to open up on him. He's a little paranoid type of guy. So we didn't stay long. But I was a kid at that time. We would go to Coney Island and visit my other uncle, their brother-in-law, Flapper Stan, Stanley Farber, who had opened in 1950 or 51. I can't remember the address off the top of my head, but in Coney Island. And I believe, I don't know if it was Eddie or Coney Island Freddy ran one of the games there when the winter time came. And so I would go with my father. You know, I knew those guys, but as an influence, you know, tattoo-wise, was Tony Polito, my uncle Barry Stan, and my father. We weren't into, this is Bert Grimm's work, this is... I thought everything was Moskowitz designs at one time. I would say to my father, hey, they took your designs. And he would just ignore me and stuff. And then I found out a lot of designs they put in their catalog and stuff, they took from. But tattooing, Sailor Jerry designs, this, he took them from somebody else. Colored the Swallow different. Color... Does the Panther different or whatever? No, it's nobody's design. Wagner took them from somebody else. Everybody took it. And in today's era, whatever, they think because it's on somebody's sheet, that was their design. I mean, you're going to tell me Sailor Jerry had the brain said, oh, let's put a swallow here. Nobody has a swallow on their design sheets, this and that. It took me a while to understand everybody stole from everybody.
It is funny that's how that it started. And now you hear people just kind of bellyaching when other people do their work or similar work. We were talking about this on a recent episode.
Once it goes on Facebook, on Instagram, whatever, it's not your design no more.
Mm-hmm. You put it out in the universe at that point.
The internet's design.
Yep.
You know how many tattoos I did? They bring me in somebody something. So you change something. You change, if it's a face, you change the look at the face. If it's a bird, you put a rose out of its beak or whatever. And it's not their design no more. In fact, when somebody sells a sheet and you see it's copyrighted, I know in the past, I don't know these modern times, the world and technology has surpassed me at my age of 69 now. But anyway, it's nobody's design. I forget a little as we go on what I'm talking about. You got to just change here and there. Oh, what I was saying, designs and copyrighted. The only thing that's copyrighted is the order of those designs. You take one design off or two designs off, and there are two other ones, that's not copy. That's, that guy's copyright is no good no more. So It's just tattooing is an industry of thieves, crooks, criminals, sex or abusers, whatever. You're reading more and more that tattooers are abusing their female customers, but that's been going on for ages. It's nothing new. In this era we live in, they think everything is new. They think there was never an LGBT community before. They think that's all new. It's been around before they were ever born, before their parents were born. I mean, they think everything, no matter what the industry is, they think everything is brand new. Next.
You know, it's funny.
Next question.
Recently, Derb and I were having a conversation about kind of like what separates this new generation of tattooers versus, like, you know, the old school. Like, and deep in our conversation, we kind of came to the conclusion that it's the biker community. You know, I came up in the biker community. I came up working poker runs, being like the official tattooer of one of my buddies' clubs that I was very closely affiliated with. But the thing that we were, throughout our conversation, the conclusion that we came to is, like, when you're in the biker community, you are surrounded by outlaws. You're surrounded by all of these things that you just listed, womanizers, yes, whatever label you want to give it. But within that community, there's so much, like, your word is your bond. You know, there's this whole other code of respect that goes along with the biker community, even though they may be criminals or whatever label, like I said, whatever label you want to give them. But there's this code of respect, and there's this code of, like, you know, you don't step on other people's toes, you don't step out of line, you don't disrespect client, let alone another tattooer. I think that's probably the big distinguishing factor. And this is just, like I said, this is just our opinion that we kind of came to through, like, a 2-hour conversation. But I really feel like that kind of entry into the community kind of, like, it hardened me in a way, but it also made it, like, you know, you have to be a good person to an extent to be successful in the tattoo community. You can't, like, leave clients hanging. You can't do other tattooers wrong. You know, things like that. But I do think that, like, the biker community was so tied into the tattoo community for so many years. And now that it's kind of, like, separating with this newer generation of tattooers, I think that's one of those things where, like, you have younger tattooers that are more easily offended, because whether they're male or female. I mean, I had to sit in that biker club, and I had to hear, like, all of my close friends even talking about women in crazy ways and talking about other guys in crazy ways. But, like, I had to have thick enough skin to know that they were just kidding and to not be offended by it, because they were just jokes. Like, however in poor taste, they were still jokes. And I think it's crazy that you bring up, like, this generation versus older generation, where, like, I feel like I'm at the very tail end, the tail end of the former generation, I guess. But yes, what did you just say?
Oh, what I was telling Mr. Wisdom, I love that name, Wisdom. But anyway, I was telling him when I used to go with my father when I was a kid to the shop that they had on Long Island when they outlawed it and they moved to Long Island. We moved to Long Island when I was born in 55, so I was 9. And how I remember that is Muhammad Ali fought Sonny Liston in 1964, and all the news and TV was one of the biggest fights of the century then, and it was always, every time you put on the TV, Liston and Ali. So that's how I could figure out what year we moved to Long Island. But anyway, I used to go to work on a weekend, on a Saturday, with my father and uncle, and all the bikers would come down. And one guy in particular, they call him the Dragon Man. He's on Facebook, Instagram. They call him the Dragon Man. He was the go-to guy for Harley Davidsons at that time. And he made a dragon bike with the tail, hence the Dragon Man. And he would come by with all, my father gave him an uncle 90% of his tattoos. And he would come down with all his buddies and the girls. And I would think in my head, a 9-10-year-old kid, if my friends could see me now. So I got used to all that at an early age. And my grandmother used to tell him it's not a place for a little boy. But when I would bring my own daughter, when I had my shop at about 7-8 years old, my mother-in-law told my wife, it's not a place for a little girl. I'd bring her on a Saturday. She would clean up for me after a tattoo, set up for the next tattoo. She loved it. But once my mother-in-law said that, that was the end of her coming down. My wife wasn't in the tattoo business, so it was all new to her, this business. But I was telling him a story when I was in junior high school. There was this real hot blonde in school, 16. We were 16, and my father knew this guy. I can't think of his name, but he was a vacuum cleaner salesman, but he was a biker, off hours. And he came down to the shop one Saturday night, and this blonde is on the back, and it's that girl. This guy was like in his 30s. She was 16, and when I would see her in school after, then she either turned and walked the other way or put like blinders up and walked by me. I blew her cover. But then when I had my own shop in Baldwin, New York, in Suffolk County, I had one of these stores where people 100 years ago would live in the back. It was like an apartment. I had a waiting room, the tattoo room, like a sunken den, and then the apartment. And these, I called them the Over the Hill Gang. They were either ex-angels, ex-pagans, just guys that rode. They like all found each other and used that sunken living room for their meeting place. So I was involved with them. There's this one guy, Artie. He did 10 years in Florida. He got out. He bought a cab in the city. He hung out with all these guys. He used to tell everybody he's my brother. And he was a troublemaker. I got in some trouble with him. So word of mouth, it's the tattoo guy's brother, said I'd come shoot at my window or break my window, whatever. But I know what you're talking about. You hear all kinds of things, you see all kinds of things, and that's life. That I was telling, I can't remember your first name. Mr. Wisdom, what's your first name? James.
James.
Right? Yes, I was telling you before, I got in a lot of trouble in that shop, and my father and uncle made me sell it, and I had to go back to work for them, because according to my father and uncle, I had to be kept on a short leash. Oh, that's my, I know what you're talking about. You hear all kinds of things, you see all kinds of, that's why I said before, nothing surprises me in this business. I mean, Sailor Jerry had a radio program. He was a real, I call it Reich, R-E-I-C-H, like the Third Reich. He was a real Reich-wing radio guy. As great and respected as he is, he said some things that some people applaud today. Guys like me doesn't sit well, but that's another type of people that went into tattooing. So, and today you got, getting back to modern days, you have prima donnas, as my father would call them, that they do this great work, but they want you to tell them it's great work, or they get insulted at you. You know, they show it to me. I said, oh, nice tattoo. That should be enough. But it's not.
I say that all the time with the social media. People will be like, I did this crazy thing and it only got this many likes. It's like, well, but it looks great in person. Like, just because it didn't happen to scroll across somebody's feed at just the right time, like, don't take that as a hit to your ego. Like,
they get insulted. It's a great
tattoo. It's okay.
They get insulted at that. I don't get it. I don't get it. Like, this guy, look, he only did a little bird. He got 500 likes. Look at my masterpiece. I got 5 likes on it. Allergies. But it's
the season.
Oh, I'm dying. Anyway, you go to these conventions today. You got me and my friend Ronnie at tattooing with coil machines. We went to one convention. It was in the Poconos somewhere. I can't remember. This was a couple of years ago. We were the only ones with coil machines. Tattoo, and everybody's using those. But they do terrific work with it. They got this thing, loyal to the coil, which irks me a little bit because, to me, you're admitting you can't do that type of work that they're doing with their the pen. I know what they call it, but to me, it's a pen. But they do.
That's funny. Well, here at Red Tree, we've got 13 artists, I believe, and we have one artist that still uses a coil machine day in and day out. Even we work with Marty Holcomb here. He comes in the evenings. But he has even recently switched, within the last couple of years, switched to a rotary machine. So,
They're all, everybody is. Well, I never used one. My theory is you can't teach an old horse new tricks, or you is that an old dog,
you know,
new
I,
tricks, and you can't lead a horse to water.
I firmly believe that anybody that's starting out tattooing should still start out with coil machines. I feel like there's a lot of like information that the machine gives you as you're working with it. There's that sound, there's that feel, and I feel like if everybody started with a coil machine, they'd have a much better, softer touch and a better understanding of what they're doing when they do switch to a rotary machine.
Right. But what I don't like about a lot of today's tattooing, a lot of it is, to my opinion, is way too dark. All this elaborate tattooing they do seems to be way too dark. A lot of black. And, I mean, I got a lot of tattoos, but as I'm aging, the detail is disappearing. Where the shading is, the shading is blending into the detail. They used to say, how's that tattoo going to look in 10 years from now? And I used to say, better than the guy wearing it. But as I'm getting older, I hope I look better than some of them are turning into. So a lot of this stuff is elaborate, but to me, there's too much black in it. And it's just going
I kind of think that's like a lack of understanding light and dark balance. I think there are a lot of tattooers that just like, I feel like James and I, whenever we're on a show together like this, we can like nerd out about like the technical side of art and design. But I think there are a lot of people that just jump into tattooing and they don't understand art yet. They don't understand that, you know, you're supposed to have light and dark in an image. You're supposed to have areas of high detail and areas of less detail. And that's how you like draw the eye, and that's how you control how you're telling the story. And I think there are a lot of people that are like, yeah, I don't need art school. I don't need this, that, or the other. You don't necessarily need art school, but you should understand the fundamentals of art when you're making art on people.
My regret myself is I never went to art school. I always meant to. I always had the time to. But I'm the type of guy, I would make plans with 3 or 4 people, people, and wherever my car took me, that's the one I kept the plans with. So I always wanted to go. I would have been a much better. I'm a tattoo artist. I'm not an artist. I do stencil work. I could draw a bird on you, maybe an eagle, but I do the stencil work, and I do what I know. How I came from an era you didn't need great artwork. My father and uncles came from an era you didn't have to do great artwork. There's a thing that puzzles me. Before World War II, you saw great artwork from Charlie Wagner, from Burke, from all these great patriotic artwork and stuff. Then somewhere, as the war started, to a few years, quite a few years after World War II, it just became, give me a panther, give me this, give me a bird. So somewhere, the great artwork disappeared, and then it came back again, which always puzzles. If you ask people when they got their tattoo, and they say during the war, or before or after, there's a difference in the work, which Tony Pulido used to tell me. When you got 20, 25 people waiting to get tattooed, you can't do artwork on them. During the war, the shops were booming. So that could be a reason. That's my theory, that some of this great artwork disappeared. I mean, my uncle could do a whole chess piece, a whole eagle, in 30 minutes, outlined and colored in, but it wasn't great artwork. I don't know if you ever saw Jack Dracula's eagle on his chest. Mm-mm. My uncle did that on him, Barry Stan. But if you see, it's all solid black, but it's no great work of art. It's an eagle, but it's no great work. I'll tell you a Jack Dracula story if you want.
Tell us, please.
Here. My uncle, Flapper Stan, Stanley Farber, had the last legal shop on Long Island, and Flappers Avenue, Brooklyn. When the ban came down, it actually wasn't made final to 1965. He had the last legal shop, and he had, at various times, Jack Dracula working for him, Tony the Pirate, Tony Cambria, and Tony Pulido working for him. Everybody passed through to Moskowitz's somehow or another. So when he had Jack Dracula working for him, my father would, on a Sunday, come down and visit him. And Dracula was making, out of plywood, full-length Warner Brothers cartoons, Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, and painted them up and stuff. Of course, I'm 10 years old, 9 years old, I want one. And my father offered him at that time up to $20 for one. And I'm a kid, I'm crying, I want one. He still wouldn't sell it. So my story ends with Jack Dracula. He could go fuck himself.
Wouldn't sell it at all, huh? Story.
No. But I met him once before then. I the first time I ever saw him, he had the circles on his eyes, and I ran down Flappish Avenue. If my father didn't catch me, I'd still be running. He was a big 6'5", scary looking guy then. My father and uncle wouldn't tattoo his face. So I forgot who did it. I think Tony the Pirate may have done it. I'm not 100% sure, but my father and uncle were pretty tight with him at one time, but they wouldn't touch his face. My father used to go on the subway with Jack Dracula. He had a full-length black coat with a hood, and they go and spook people on the subway with his face tattooed and everything.
Well, hey,
that's my Jack Dracula.
I'd like to show your website, if we could. And
my website is BoweryTattoo.com. B-O-W. Oh.
Yeah, right here.
There it is.
And so I'm going to put up a QR code. So for those of you who are interested, you could scan this QR code. It'll take you right to the Moskowitz Family Tattoo website. I got a chance to check it out a little bit earlier, and It's a real dive into the history. Let's see here. I wanted to, we'll look at pictures and I think that could really spark some conversation. And I'll really start off here. We're like, so Willie, this is your grandfather. Yes.
That's my grandfather, Willie. He came from a border town in Russia and Poland. I was in Krakow, Poland for my 60th birthday. And I asked the guide, the name of his town, was it Polish? You know, it's one of those towns. One day it was Poland, the next day it was Russia. So I gave him the name of the town and the year that he left. And she said that he's Russian. He's 100% Russian. And when I told her, what do you think a Russian immigrant became in America? And I told her a tattoo artist, she was thrilled to death to hear that. And the middle one is my dad. He started tattooing on the Bowery full-time at 16 years old. He was married and had me on the way. And the other one's me. We ran out of room for my two uncles, but that's all right.
So when your grandfather got to America,
America, he came here in 1919. His father had come 5 years before the family. I don't know if you ever heard of Carmen Nyssen. She's an intense genealogist, and she found out all of my uncle's, my grandfather's history. So he came here in 1919, and in 1930 or 29, he bought a barbershop on the Bowery, number 8 Bowery. And he was a barber. He went to a barber school. Anyway, he was a barber, and in the back room, he rented it out to what they call transient tattoo artists. And one of them was, I don't know if you ever heard of Al Neville. You ever hear of Al Neville?
No, I'm jotting it down.
Al Neville is the guy that gave the tattoo machine to Norman Rockwell to study when Norman Rockwell was doing that painting of the sailor with all the tattoos on him, you know, with the names crossed out.
Classic.
That's where Al Neville gave him the tattoo machine to study.
So I think I would ask, we all likely romanticize the Bowery. Like we think it was so, you know.
I'll give you a little history as told to me by my uncle Bowery Stan and my father.
All right.
The Bowery was a bucket of blood. It was near Little Italy, Chinatown. At that time, the Bowery was more Little Italy than Chinatown. You had the mobsters, you had all the sailors, the Marines, the Army guys. You had people coming from Connecticut, out of state, most of them looking for trouble. My grandfather, he loved the Bowery. He loved the characters. He loved the friends. He loved the action. He loved the Bowery. Tony Polito used to tell me you couldn't get him off the Bowery because his excuse was, well, one more guy may come in for a tattoo. One more guy may come in for a tattoo. So, according to my father and uncle, they got into a lot of fights all the time. A lot of fights. There's a story that my uncle Flapper Stan and my aunt told me is that Bowery Stan, Flapper Stan, and my grandfather were working at the shop one night, and some guy came in and just out of nowhere punched my grandfather. So the two Stanleys beat the guy. They thought they beat him to death. They took him to a lot and threw him at a lot. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, they decided to go back to make sure a body isn't there or to hide a body. But the guy was gone. So, and my aunt tells me, Flatbush Stan's wife tells me, her husband kept just pacing up and down. She kept saying, what's wrong? says, I got to call your brother up. We'll be back in a little bit. So that's one episode. You ever hear of the gangster Crazy Joe Gallo?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Crazy Joe Gallo used to hang out in a store, a couple of stores down from, at that time, I'm trying to think, it was number 4 Bowery they were at. And they used to have PS6 brawls there, and he used to come in and help them out. In fact, he once hit a cop that came in to squash the battle over the head with a chair. We had the old barber chairs with the wire frame and the wood seat, and we had about 6 of them. We sold them each as the chair they used, that the Crazy Joe Gallo used to hit a cop over the head. So one of those 6 people have the real chair. They threw my father and uncle into the tombs one day. They had a real bad fight. And when they squashed it, they arrested everybody. My aunt and my mother had to go down and bail Barry Stan and my father out. And there were 2 guys standing in front of the judge ahead of them. It was the 2 guys they had a fight with, and my aunt said that they says, these ain't my husbands. Who are these guys? They couldn't recognize the guys my father and uncle had the big fight with. And you ever hear of Bill Collinsworth, Sailor Bill Collinsworth?
I feel like it sounds familiar, but anyway, I can't place any stories.
He was, I'll tell you a story. He comes in to the barber shop, number 4, the shop they had at number 4 Bowery, which was the second one. My grandfather was still cutting hairs before he got sick. And my father and uncle were having a fight with these another two guys. And one guy was on the floor rolling around. Bill Collinsworth comes in, takes out a gun, and puts it to the guy's head. He tells my father, uncle, you want me to finish him? He says, no, they're finished already. Don't worry, Bill. We don't need any help. So that's how the Bowery was in those days. Later years, when they would tell people stories about all these fights, my uncle would tell me they're glorifying this. We were young guys. We had kids. We were trying to put food on the table. And we had to go through this bullshit just to make a living. So, you know, the younger guys glorified it, but the thing of, as my father and uncle thought about it, it kind of made them, their stomach turns of what they had to go through to make a living. So but all through the years, the Bowery was known for cutthroats, thieves, almost like the tattoo business.
Like a rite of passage to come through the Bowery.
More or less. I mean, you had just trouble, mate. I'll tell you another story. You had a lot of mobsters. My father was friends with this guy. I can't think of his name. He was older than my father. What the hell is that? That's my phone somewhere, but I don't know what it is. I can't think of the guy's name. He was a captain, and he was whacked when John Gotti was coming up. But anyway, he was friends with him, and he always wanted to put my father into some kind of business. But my father used to tell him, I have 2 young kids, and it's not for me. But anyway, one night, my father hears these the kids of these mobsters. Let's go in and give the tattoo guys a good fucking. So as they walked in, my father laid one guy out, my uncle laid another guy out, and the other guys ran. And they had to go to a sit-down. And this guy that my father was friendly with tells the other guy's fathers, your kids are scumbags, case closed. So that's how the Bowery was. It has a history of being like that. They used to go down to work at the Bowery, and they saw this long line going around the block of people waiting for them to open up, and they used to get lost for an hour or so. So the line people would leave and there weren't so many guys. You ever hear of Dick Hyland, the human autograph?
No, you're throwing some new names at me.
Oh, Dick Hyland, you'll have to give me your email. I'll send you a couple of articles I have and pictures of him and stuff. I'll definitely connect those with you. A denizen of the Bowery, a citizen of the Bowery. In fact, the New York Post and the Gotham columnist had a little paragraph on him, the newest citizen of the Bowery. He passed them off. There was a famous boxer in California fighting Dick Hyland, who for years I thought was the same guy. But like I said, Carmen Nyssen researched him for me. The Dick Hyland that worked the front of my grandfather and uncle's shops passed them off as this guy. It wasn't him. He was arrested quite a few times for impersonating fighting Dick Hyland. But anyway, I got an article. He was once arrested for stabbing a guy in Charlie Wagner's shop. But anyway, he found my grandfather. My grandfather gave him a job watching the front. I'll get back to that. Well, I go ahead. When I talk, I go point A, point C, and back to point B.
Marvin, anyway. I just want to let you know, I pulled up this the article by Carmen, it's a really thorough and interesting article for sure.
Yeah, there's one on Dick Hyland, and there's one on my Uncle Bowery's Flatbush stand. And yeah, I don't know if you know.
In the audience, you know what I mean? Just for people in the audience, this is a really great article. If you really want to learn more about this side of tattoo history, American electric tattooing. And I think that, again, like we've been talking about, that, you know, tattoos culturally are they're a rite of passage. They've really attracted a lot of, let's call it subcultures, right? Bikers or hippies or wherever you kind of find it, gangsters, right? Wherever you find yourself, we're all probably outside of some type of, you know, whatever normal means. And tattoos is really kind of an interesting way that that people kind of set themselves apart in different ways. And this particular, you know, like article and the stories you're telling, I think it's really important to recognize that, again, the history of the Bowery, it was very violent. It was probably awful in a lot of ways. And then, you know, through it, like what came out of it, this, you know, this art form that we're really all enjoying today. And so I think that the photographs in here, and then there's also some paintings and stuff, which are really cool. Yeah. Again, this almost looks like romantic, but I bet it was a pretty tough existence, right? Every day.
Oh, yes.
It's scratching the tattoos.
I found out in later years, you know, I grew up in that neighborhood in Northport I was telling you before, and I had run into an old high school friend of mine. He said, I don't know if you noticed or not, but everybody was scared to death of your father. Now, my father, when he was home, there was a different person, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I guess his demeanor and stuff kind of terrorized. My father was the type of guy that didn't take gruff. In fact, if I talk back, the only thing he didn't take is if I talk back to my mother, he would smack me in the back of the head and say, who do you think you're talking to, your scumbag friends in the street? Now, funny story, when he passed away, and me and my siblings are telling stories about him, and I mentioned that, they all almost said all at once, the three of them, Daddy never said anything like that about our friends. No. You know,
well,
memories. My father used to say, when I'm gone, I'll become a memory. No. But he was an imposing guy. I remember as a kid going to the shop with him, and if the customers talked back to him or whatever, if the guy was with his girlfriend or wife, my father would say, How would you like if I broke every bone in your body in front of your girl here? And then my uncle would come out with his ball peen hammer or the straight razor between his fingers, and no fight happened at that point. But a funny story is, whenever there was trouble in the store, my father would tell me, every time there was ever trouble, it was my brother and your grandfather. And if my father started something, my Uncle Barry Stan would tell me, every time we ever had trouble, it was my father and your father. So they put the blame on each other whenever there was trouble.
Well, I think I won't get into too many details myself, but you know, I've certainly experienced wild violence inside of tattoo shops throughout my own personal, you know, career. And I think that I would be glad, right, if that wasn't the experience of others. You know what I mean? Like, having all these things, they're incredible stories, and I mean, they are formative in certain ways, but it's just not, you know, so not necessary. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be like that. And
You ever hear Eddie Funk's Crazy Eddie story, how he met my father and uncle for the first time?
Ooh, I hoped you would talk about this.
Okay. You heard the story?
No.
Oh, okay. Eddie and my father were about the same age, I guess. And my father was working at the shop on the Bowery, and Eddie kept walking around the block looking for the shop. And my father sees him and says, "Hey, kid, you looking for the tattoo shop?" Eddie says, "Yes." So you ever see the big eagle Eddie has on his chest?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father put those two swallows underneath, those two birds underneath it, one on each side. So my father does the tattoos. Eddie looks in the mirror and he says, "Hey, one is higher and one is lower." And my father smacked him in the back of the head and says, "Don't you know anything? One's a male, one's a female." So then Eddie says, "Where's my $10 change?" And my father smacks him in the head again and says, "On the chest, it's extra." So they got in a little argument. And then my Uncle Barry Stan comes from the back with his hammer and says, "You giving my brother a hard time?" So Eddie says, "Then I thought it was time to go." And the moral is, there started a lifelong friendship between the three of them. And every time I saw Eddie, till he passed away, he told me the same story. Ever tell you the first time I met your father? And according to my mom, Eddie is basically, until Tony Pulido came along, the only tattooer my father and mother ever socialized with. My father didn't, you know, when he wasn't in the shop, he didn't want to know nothing about the tattooer. But that's the stories. That if trouble didn't come to you, you made your trouble. That's what
it's
I used
so to- crazy. You've got such a rich, such a rich tattoo history and such a rich family history with all these people that, like, you just grew up with people that would be like life-changing for the average artist. Well,
Tony Pulido used to have, he lived in Brooklyn. This is, my father's dead 17 years, so this is after we used to meet him and his wife Sugar at night at this seafood place when we would close up, and we would meet Tony and his wife sometimes. I would meet Tony, like I said, they sent me to him to get fine-tuned tattooing. So then we would go eat Chinese food for a couple of hours and until your stomachs reached the end of the table. Chinese food and tattooing, one was invented for one or the other. Because a lot of the old timers, their stories revolve around Chinese food. When they first sent the health department to outlaw the tattooing in the five boroughs, Manhattan and the five boroughs, everybody had their electric autoclaves. And they would open them up. One guy had lobsters he was keeping warm. Some had Chinese food. They all had their dinners being kept warm in the sterilizers. So,
man, I can't. I can't imagine, because things were crazy, but I can't imagine actually using an autoclave to heat my dinner.
You got to keep something to keep it warm. A lot of times, and this is from my own personal experience, you could be dead all day. You go out and bring your dinner back to the store. All of a sudden, you got 3-4 guys waiting to get tattooed. So instead of eating, you tattoo them. So you got to keep your food warm somehow. This is before microwaves.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm joking. But no, that's how it was back then. There was no... I'll tell you another story. My father, when they came up around in the late 50s, early 60s, the health department, when they start trying to get the tattooers out, the ink was powdered. And when it dried out, you just put some more fresh powder in the souffle cup and you added your Listerine or alcohol, whatever. My father says, I didn't change my inks in years. When they took it to test, I says to my brother, they're going to put us out of business. It came back from the Board of Health's lab. Not a thing wrong with it.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That Listerine was magic Listerine back then.
Well, whatever it was.
One of the things working with Marty, my room is like right across the hall from his. So sometimes when he's got one of his like older clients or like, you know, somebody he's been tattooing for years and years, they get to telling stories. And one of the things that I love is hearing him talk about Stony St. Clair and how they used to have like the communal bucket in the shop, like the just a sponge with a bucket.
That was Charlie Wagner's. Around that. That was Charlie Wagner's thing.
Ugh. I mean, nobody, I know everybody did it, but ugh.
When they overturned in 95, when they overturned the law outlawing tattooing, the Board of Health said it, because don't forget, when they outlawed it, you had 100 guys that went underground tattooing. And right. They admitted it has never been then or now a health hazard. They had to admit that. So,
I mean, you hear of things happening, but it really is few and far between, even with like the crazy circumstances.
First of all, it's hard to say if it was the tattooer's fault. How many times did you tattoo when you used to tell them just to put the Vaseline on it? They come back with the whole jar of Vaseline on the tattoo and ask you why it's dripping off their arm. You go out and get sunburned the day after and ask you why it's all screwed up, the tattoo. You know, it's hard to tell if the tattoo artist or the person that got it.
Yeah, that's true.
But, well, you always blame the guy that the guy did something. That's, the number one thing you say. I didn't do that. You did it. But it's just, you know, people are funny. People are funny. What I don't get is they get these huge pieces today and a guy will work on them for a week or two in a row. Mm-hmm. The skin doesn't get eaten up, doesn't get irritated. You're going over sometimes the same part. I was at a tattoo convention and the guy next to me for 3 days of the convention, he was working on the same tattoo, the same spot. I looked at it. It looked like chopped meat already.
You see it both ways. I myself have been worked on multiple days in a row. Uh-huh. But I've also seen people where they're just trying to blast out huge pieces at a convention to win those awards. But by the time it's award time, the skin's so beat up and so obliterated and so... And like, I've been going to conventions long enough that I'll see some of these pieces come back. Like you're saying, they're just powering through to get the tattoo done in 3 days, where like, if they would have split that up and taken like 3 or 4 months to do it, like the body probably would be happier with, it'd be a better tattoo in the end. Oh, there's this huge back piece I saw one year being done in Detroit. It was a huge skull. Off the top of my head, I can't remember the artist that did it, but he was using big mags and he blasted out this skull and it looked relatively detailed. The darks looked relatively dark in it. But here we are 4 years later, I see the same back piece and it's just cracks all over the place. The detail that was in it there for the weekend, a lot of it had fallen out because the skin was like, he took home an award that weekend because it did look nice. But I happened to be judging. So I was like, this does look good now, but this is going to need some serious touch-ups just because of how the skin is and like it's reacting. Yeah. And sure enough, I saw it at another convention this year, the same exact piece, and it healed, unfortunately, just as rough as I thought it would. I mean, at the same time, I've seen pieces where I'm like, that's going to heal rough, and I see it, and it's perfect. So, but those multiple day sessions, like sometimes when I'm traveling, it's worthwhile to sit through multiple days or have my clients sit multiple days without racing deadline to complete the piece is kind of scary.
I see people that actually will get a big piece, but they'll wait every year for the same convention for the same guy to show up. You know, the guy does some more work, like a bodysuit and stuff. Could you show a picture of the audiobook? I just want to give it a little plug with the kid slug tattooed, and I'll explain what it is.
Well, I'll look that, let me look it up and,
And I'll start explaining it.
Go ahead and start explaining it. And could you name it again?
Yeah, it's called Last of the Bowery Scab Merchants. Last of the Bowery Scab Merchants. My father died of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the last year of his life, my kid brother, who I'm actually 17 years older than, decided he bought all this recording equipment and interviewed my father. First, it was going to be just an interview about his life and stuff. Then it became a labor of love, and he went into the tattooing end of his life. So it's a two-disc CD of my father telling his life story as a Bowery tattooer, as a tattooer on Long Island, a little life stories. We have three boxing historians, Mike McCabe, Eldridge, what's his name? The guy with the book mistress, Chuck Eldridge, and Marissa, I can't think of her name. It's a Greek last name, but they give their take on the Moskowitz family. It's very interesting. Some interviews with cousins and stuff, but it's basically my father's stories. And he'll name some Bowery tattoo artists like Jack Redcloud. I can't offhand think of the other names he mentions. And it's part of this. It comes with a 22-page booklet of photos and stories. It also has my friend Slats. He did 40-some-odd years behind bars. He was a soldier for the Colombo crime family. I meet them all some point in my life. I met them all. But anyway, we interviewed him. He had tattoos from Charlie Wagner. My brother interviewed him, so it's him telling how he got tattooed, him and his friends at Charlie Wagner's place. It's anybody that wants to know tattoo history. And we only sell it. It's going to be a collector's item. The only thing is you need a CD player to listen to it, something that's already
I'm going to have to grab myself a copy of this because my van still has a CD player in it, and I spend a lot of time on the road.
We get $30 plus $5 postage.
Nice. Yeah, I'd love to hear all these stories. And it's
terrific.
We're getting to a place like we kind of started off the conversation talking about like the differences in the modern generation of tattooing versus like the older generation of tattooing. And these stories are the foundation of what we get to do today. This make-believe job that we have, it was a make-believe job back then, but it was so much rougher.
My father used to say, You know what tell my me. Father used to say when he has to, he would tell a guy, I would tell it when I worked the front, I would tell a guy a price. And then my father, the guy would hem and horse, and my father would lowball him, and the guy would get the tattoo. I always went for the higher price. But anyway, my father would do it, and I would tell him, why'd you do it for that price? He says, you got to be lucky that they actually let us do this to them. Mm-hmm. So I was brought up, whatever the guy got in his pocket, you don't care how much he has or how little, the idea is to put what he's in his pocket in your pocket. So that was my father's philosophy.
Yep, that's something so I like to remind. Go ahead. I was just going to say one of the things that I always like to remind people that, like, as amazing as this job is and amazing you get to hear and be a part of, if it wasn't for the collector walking in with $50 in their pocket or $200 in their pocket or $500 in their pocket, if it wasn't for that person, we don't have a job. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I think a lot of people, like the prima donnas that you mentioned earlier, a lot of people just don't want to work for less. And I've learned over the years that sometimes doing that tattoo for less, knowing that that's all the money that they have, like making that compromise, I've now sealed the deal and I have that client forever. Yeah.
Yes. When Mike Tyson came along, he had Mike tattooed on his arm. When he finally became a name, every black person, every white kid was coming in. They want their name, their own name on them. I mean, it was like every day you did 20, 30 names. And my father would charge $25 and giant letters, whatever their name was, with a little scrolling or whatever. And I says, what do you do? It's so cheap. He says, you see that $25? When we stop at the diner on the way home, that's going to buy me and you a whole 3-course meal. He says,
mm-hmm.
What, you think I'm going to find $25 on the street? He says, that's all they could afford. But all these athletes that are all covered, the baseball, the basketball players, the fighters, you could credit that all to Mike Tyson. All these athletes barely had a tattoo on them until Mike Tyson came along and he had Mike on his arm. I credit that to Mike Tyson. It gave a cottage industry to the tattooers.
That's a pretty awesome observation. That was definitely before my time.
I'm a big boxing fan. Make that connection. I spent all my money instead of on tattooing collecting, on boxing collecting. I got cartons of all kinds of, I got a Muhammad Ali card. They call it an arcade card or exhibition card. I was offered sight unseen, $800 for it. The only thing is, every time I take it out, I was tempted. I look at it, it's still shiny to me. It's still a shiny object. So it goes back in the collector's book with my cards and stuff. So I can't. I tell my daughter, I got all kinds of one-of-a-kind press photos and this. My bedroom at home is the only place I was allowed to do it. It's like a museum between the tattooing and the boxing pictures. I got a lot of autographed boxing pictures from the older fighters and stuff. From the bottom of the wall to the top of the wall. Guests come into my house, visitors. And they spend, and I give them the story behind every photo and stuff. Some photos I'm with the people, some are autographed to me. But I just bought a thing I saw on eBay, liquor decanters. They used to make boxes. I have one with Rocky Marciano was a liquor decanter. So I just saw one. It's like an old bare knuckle fighter like that. So I'm looking at a picture. I bought it. The thing's that big. I don't know if you see the size I'm making it. It's that big. I got nowhere to put it. But I look at it. And my brothers and everything, you should start selling it. You're going to be 70 years old. You're not in that good health. He says, well, when I die, you'll decide what to do with it. But I tell my daughter, I only have one daughter. He says, when I die, these things have value. Just don't get rid of it. She says, in other words, when you die, I'm going to inherit all your crap, she says. My daughter's something else.
You've said that you called yourself like the last
The last man standing.
You're the last one in the business, and you said your daughter is going to go into the
My tattoo. Daughter got 2 master's degrees. She ain't interested in tattooing. My 10-year-old grandson, I have a brother that lives up in Provincetown, and that's like my daughter and her family's summer home. They go up a couple of times a year. They love it up there. My brother lives there. And the kids all get to paint on tattoos and stuff. So I asked them recently, I don't know if you could see this tattoo, the Reaper. And it says, and there's a little kid there. It says, your time is up.
Hold on a second, Marvin. Show that one more time if you can. You hold it up a little higher.
Are you?
Yeah, there it is. Oh, yeah, that one.
My 10-year-old awesome. Grandson. Designed this. He drew it, you know, like a 10-year-old. And when I go up to Provincetown at Coastline Tattoo, great people, I'm friends with them. So I asked Effie, her name is, if she can make it into a tattoo. So this is her version of what he drew. And I texted him the picture, you know, my daughter and stuff. I made his picture into a tattoo. He was elated. He sent me some monster he drew hanging a head by the rope. I'm sitting in the pollen is falling right on me. Excuse me. And he says, well, to tell you the truth, I only got one more spot, and that's for your sister. She's 7. So they were out last month. And I says, well, you want to design me a tattoo? She designs me a teddy bear with the, you know, the X's for the eyes, with an arrow through its throat with a drop of blood coming off of it from these 2 little kids. So I asked them, are you going to get tattooed like Papa Marvin? My grandson says, no way, they sew them on your arm. I says, what are you talking about? My daughter says, I told them they do it with needles, so they think they sew it on you.
That's hilarious. I love it.
That's well. You get old.
We're coming up on the hour, and so I wanted to give you a chance, Marvin, to plug your upcoming conventions because you're going to go and do some tattoos and
yes, we have a booth there.
Convention.
It's
where can we find you?
I don't know the booth numbers yet. It's not to the end of July. The last weekend of July. Look on the New York Tattoo Convention, CIV. Anthony, I can't think of his name now, but he's the guy that has the band Gorilla Biscuits. He owns Lotus Tattoo on Long Island. You could look up his name. It's Tattooing. It's a music hall. I can't think of the name of it. Up on the roof, they're going to have skateboarding contests, bands. Hopefully inside is soundproof a little bit because they're like heavy metal bands, I guess. That's not my type of thing. I'm still into Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Cream and Eric Clapton and Dylan and stuff. So you'd have to look it up and see. There's going to be some other events in the city, tattoo events, an exhibition of the Liberty tattoos. If you go on my Facebook, you'll see the advertisement for the. I'll send you the. If you go on my Facebook, you'll see the advertise or on my Instagram. My Instagram, the latest picture is the advertisement for it.
Ah, yes. Let me see if I can pull up your Instagram right now, so we can. This. Yeah. Here we go. So here is your
there it is, the first one. Oh, and there's the audio book next to it.
Here's a picture. I meant to jump onto this one. So this is your upcoming convention dates and place. Yes.
And if they want to contact me, they could just leave me messages on Instagram. And anytime you want to do part two, just let me know.
That's excellent. So anyway, you can find Marvin. It's a New York City Tattoo Arts Convention. I don't think it says your booth number,
no,
but
no booth. There's no booth.
Probably hard to miss, I bet.
They're still putting it together, everything. Cool. You'll see Ronnie Delacquilla's banner, and you'll see my banner is my grandfather tattooing, and with little circles on top of it of the famous picture of my grandfather, Bowery Stan, Dick Hyland, the human autograph. We never talked about him, did we? And my father kneeling down.
Too much richness to cover all of it. So, yeah, we got to have you back for a part
two.
Yes,
whenever you want to do a part two, I'm usually available. If I ain't having 100% blockage removed.
I love getting a chance to record these stories, right?
This somebody is has to. Can I just say one thing that irks me? Nothing about you guys. That there's people now telling stories about the Moskowitz family have no idea about the Moskowitz family. I just wanted to put that out there. If they want to contact me for information or whatever, they could just contact me. But if you're going to do something about the Moskowitz family, you should at least talk to somebody from the Moskowitz family. That's my biggest irk about now, present time.
Keep the Moskowitz name out your mouth. You know what I mean? So
listen, I had 15 amateur boxing matches and one professional boxing match. But the only thing I could do these days is run and not very far.
It's been a pleasure to get a chance to.
It's been my pleasure.
Talk to the source, you know what I mean? To talk to a real source of this history. Yes. And I would also love to read, you know, if your daughter ever does a study, you know, psychologically into tattooing as a cultural practice, I think that'd be an amazing history as well.
My daughter works mainly with children, but who knows? You can never tell. She got a master's in psychology and a master's in social work. She has a little office in Brooklyn, and she works with. The only thing that frustrates her is you're sending the children back to the problem. So she tries her best.
And I don't know. I guess I do feel like in a lot of ways, like the way we think about what's beautiful, and even the way we might go about selecting, like what tattoo are you going to get? It's so unconscious. It's so a part of all of the things that, you know, kind of make you this unknown knowledge, like, you know, stuff, but you don't know that you know it. And so much of that is, it comes out, right? You're like, there's a truth about you that comes out through the tattoos that you end up putting.
Oh yeah, of course you could tell. Well, I'm not one of those guys that got any themes, but you could tell a lot of people from the tattoos that they have.
Yeah.
A lot of people, I'm Jewish. But a lot of people in my lifetime with the tattoos, as I'm tattooing them, would say anti-Semitic things or off-color things about Jews without thinking. I once was at a bar with this girl a friend introduced me to. I kind of had my hand on her ass. She's kissing my neck. And then they showed something on the TV about Jews. And she says, "What about those Jews? I can't stand them," she says. Of course, I had tattoos. She never thought that I might be Jewish. So people get a perception. I went off the conversation a little. Things pop in my head that come out.
I think it's a really important conversation that I'd love to hear more about it. And so I think we're, you know, when you're ready to talk about that, you know, definitely have you on, and we should, you know,
don't
we
get
should
me like about it.
It's important.
If
it's
you have something else, some of the tattoo people not like my views about politics and stuff. I'm a liberal's liberal.
A liberal's liberal. Nice.
Huh?
Amazing. I said a liberal's liberal. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, amazing. I'm gearing up for the revolution. The cops ever came to my garage, they'd be taking me out in handcuffs.
Oh, no.
Well, it's again, it's just amazing to get a chance to meet you virtually. I got to get out and see you live.
Okay, go ahead. And just let me know when you want to do round two or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to do it soon. But thank you so much, Marvin. I want to plug real quick the Hell City Tattoo Convention. It's coming up
real fast.
May 17th through the 19th in Columbus.
In Ohio, about 2 miles up the road.
I'm not health-wise up to that yet. Too soon.
No, we love. Yeah, it's we kind of come out to New York and see you. But there's one other.
Gabe, we keep making plans, me and Gabe and Mark, but they keep falling through.
Yeah. Yeah. Another great event, the Tattooerpreneur Conference. It's coming up. It's going to be live at Red Tree, June 23rd through the 24th.
On this stage.
Yeah, right there. Where Fawn is. So, Fawn, you're in Columbus.
We're also in Columbus, Ohio.
I'm in Indianapolis. That's where I'm. I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana. So we're all over the country.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. We've got the reinventing. It's like a net,
right?
Yeah, isn't that? I mean, I really appreciate that. Technology can kind of bring us together again. Another topic I'd love to talk about because, you know, your family, the Moskowitz, had a lot to do with this infrastructure of tattoo equipment, right? Machines and all the developments and stuff.
We made the battery machine, which was an animal marker, but people used it to learn to tattoo.
Wow.
Including me on my friends, which my father didn't know about.
You got to learn somewhere.
That's right. Anyway, I'm going to let you go.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. Yeah,
and it's been a wonderful conversation. I definitely would love to talk more tattoo history and your family history again. Have a great
day. Thank you, Marvin. Appreciate you.
From Beverly Hills Wave. Okay.
Love it. So one last thing. We got the Paradise Tattoo Gathering coming up. I don't even know.
Hey, that's in October.
Yeah, October.
That's in what, October?
That might be close enough to you. Maybe Paradise.
I was supposed to come last year, but I had a blockage, 100% blockage that time that I ended up in the hospital the weekend I was supposed to be there. So, like I said, since 2022, I had 4 procedures for 100% blockages. But anyway.
Well, the machine. All right.
Stay strong.
Yes.
Keep recovering, and we'll see you in October for sure.
That's awesome.
Yes. Definitely, if I'm still around. Okay, bye-bye.
You better. Bye. Bye-bye. All right, and then also Tattoo Now. Tattoo Now is technology for tattooers. If you need some solutions for your communication, check out Tattoo Now. Ask for Gabe. And then, of course, we'd like to thank Guy Atchison for being the founder and inspiration behind the Reinventing the Tattoo Community. Thanks, Guy. This really is a great space, and
Name from Mr. Wisdom.
I won't. I'm sticking with it. It was. I had no say. I was born this way. That's all I can say. So.
Even better.
Fawn, thank you so much for for having me on. This is Fawn and Gabe's show, and I was just pinch hitting for Gabe. So I really appreciate it.
This will be on YouTube, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
This is on YouTube.
I tried to put it on my Facebook also, but I couldn't get it.
You'll be able to add the link. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, you should be
all right, guys.
Thank you.
All right, guys.
Clicking the leave button. We'll see you all next week.